You can support the Historians Podcast by clicking the GoFundMe link on bobcudmore.com.
My name is Katie Turner Getty, and I am an independent researcher and writer and a frequent contributor to the Journal of the American Revolution. And my current research topics range from the siege of Boston to prisoners of war during the American Revolution held in the prison ships and jails of New York City.
This is the Historians Podcast, and I'm Bob Cudmore. Katie Turner Getty, as she told us, is a Boston lawyer, writer, independent researcher. She earned her law degree at Knight from New England Law in Boston, cum laude. She holds a BA from Wellesley with a focus on revolutionary America, and you're a graduate of Bunker Hill Community College. I just wanted to stop on that for a moment. Bunker Hill Community College in Wellesley. That was quite a jump, or was it? Am I being too patronizing about that?
No, not at all. Absolutely, it was. I began as a community college student at Bunker Hill Community College, which is right in historic Charlestown, Massachusetts, in the shadow of the Bunker Hill Monument. So for a young Revolutionary War enthusiast, this was a fabulous place to be, also very close to home, as I'm a lifelong Bostonian, born and bred in Boston. And I graduated from Bunker Hill with a two-year associate's degree, but I did make the jump to Wellesley College as a transfer student and earned a history degree there with a focus on Revolutionary America. So I'm straddling two different worlds, for sure.
I guess. How did you convince the people at Wellesley that you were Wellesley material or something like that? You must have done well at Bunker Hill.
I did. You know, I did. And that is such an interesting question. And I think it's not one that I think typically springs to mind, but it's a very important question because I did not fit the mold of a traditional Wellesley students. I was a first-generation college student. Nobody in my family had ever been to college. And I worked my way through community college, and yet I met professors that developed an interest in me and my academic career, and I felt so supported that they kind of, I think, inculcated in me this idea of furthering my education, you know, formally furthering it in a setting that really I had never even imagined. I had honestly never even really heard of Wellesley College.
Hillary went there, didn't she? Hillary Rodham Clinton?
Yes, absolutely, yes. And she still has pretty strong ties to the college as well.
In Bunker Hill, it was an important battle at the near the start of the American Revolution. Did you study that when you were at Bunker Hill Community College?
I did. I took several history courses at Bunker Hill because it's an absolute passion of mine. History is a passion, but really the revolution in particular has been a lifelong passion of mine. I think I got it from my dad because he began taking me to local historic sites in the Boston area beginning when I was about 3 years old. So it was just kind of in my blood, and taking history classes at Bunker Hill, you know, really right where the Battle of Bunker Hill occurred. And so it was this kind of, it's a great feeling to be studying the material while you're in the place. It's very powerful even to walk the Bunker Hill battlefield today.
Now, maybe this is a case of a little knowledge is a dangerous thing. Somewhere over the years, I've heard the phrase, well, they call it the Battle of Bunker Hill, but it was really on Breed's Hill, was it?
That's true. And it's a fascinating topic. In the Charlestown area, it's a peninsula. It's bordered by the Mystic River and the Charles River. And there's been some landfill in the modern era, but at the time, it was a peninsula, and there were two prominent hills Breed's Hill and Bunker's Hill. But really, Breed's Hill was just kind of a pasture at the time. These hills, the names of these hills were not really super well known, even to people living in the Boston area at the time. Charlestown was very, very bucolic. It was like farmland. And Breed's Hill was a little bit lower, and it was closer to the Boston Peninsula. And it's like kind of an estuary region where the Mystic River and the Childs River kind of meet. Boston Harbor is there. And so this waterway is separating Charlestown and Boston. Breed's Hill was much closer to Boston, which was occupied by the British. And Bunker Hill is a bit larger and taller and set back. And so what happened was, when the Americans decided to fortify Bunker Hill, a party went out, but some officers, and this is a little bit shrouded in mystery, I think nobody really knows what happened, but some officers decided to fortify Breed's Hill instead of Bunker Hill. And whether that was a mistake, maybe they didn't know where they were in the dock, or maybe they thought it made more strategic sense. What happened was, when the sun came up that morning, the British saw the Americans entrenched on Breed's Hill, like looming right over Boston, and they were a lot closer to Boston than they would have been had they fortified Bunker Hill, so they probably had kind of a more threatening presence. And the British kind of immediately decided, we need to get that hill back now.
Mm-hmm. And in the battle, the British won, didn't they? But it was at a great cost to them.
Yes, very much so. At the end of the day, the British succeeding in driving the Americans back off the Charlestown Peninsula. It took them three times. They ascended Breed's Hill three times and got driven back twice under withering musket fire. But the Americans began to run out of gunpowder. And so their firing kind of petered out. The third wave, the third assault, was successful and succeeded in driving the Americans back. The British took the hill, but I think there were over 1,000 casualties, which was just an unbelievable number. So they took the hill, but at a very high cost.
Mm-hmm. And maybe this brings us to something that we can discuss, one of the topics you have researched and written about, the British prison ships. Because maybe we have, or some people have, an erroneous notion about the American Revolution as compared to, let's say, the American Civil War or other wars that have been fought, that the Revolution was more gentlemanly, but it was very brutal, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. And I think in terms of prisoners of war, thousands of Americans were taken prisoner. I think probably starting in earnest with the battles of New York. The Americans lost New York to the British in 1776. And at that time, thousands of Americans were taken captive. But I think there was a sense of exigency in terms of where to hold these prisoners. And so due to space constraints, I think they began to be loaded onto prison ships and held there. In some cases, those Americans would later be transferred to land jails in New York City. Some buildings during the occupation of New York were repurposed from structures like sugar refineries or churches were repurposed into jails to hold American prisoners. And the same thing happened with ships, with British Royal Navy warships. They were kind of stripped down, hulked, and moored in the East River or the Hudson River, and prisoners would be loaded onto those ships and held there. And the conditions in the jails, but also aboard the ships, were absolutely abysmal, and men died in droves.
Did the British use prison ships in their other wars, or is this a kind of an American Revolution development?
That's a very very interesting question. My understanding is that in the 17th century, there were prison ships on the Thames River in London. That's the only other instance that I'm aware of where they were used. But certainly in the American Revolution, they were all about the New York City area and particularly concentrated in an area called Wallabout Bay, which is in the East River, right off the coast of Brooklyn. And there was such a heavy concentration of prison ships there, including one notorious ship that I think people even today are kind of familiar with, was the Jersey prison ship, where that was in service for almost the whole war, holding American men. And the men that died on the Jersey were buried on the Brooklyn shore. And during the later construction of the Brooklyn Navy Yard, several bones, many hundreds, if not thousands of bones, were uncovered due to the burial site of the men being disturbed during the construction of the Navy Yard.
Well, let me ask you more about the Jersey, which became a prison ship. So originally it was a British warship?
Yes, exactly. And it was a very old one. I think it was originally built in about the 1730s. So by the time of the Revolution, it was about 30 or 40 years old, beginning to kind of decompose, not in good condition. And so it was decommissioned and moored in the East River. And it was quite large. I think it might have been about a 64-gun ship. And so they basically removed, you know, all of the guns. They closed up all the portholes in the ship. They drilled some air holes for the men. But typically what would happen is when prisoners were captured and were put on board a prison ship, they were generally kept in the hold underneath the decks and locked in the hold overnight in very, very crowded conditions, extremes of weather, as you can imagine, suffocating heat in the warm months and frigid frostbite-inducing cold in the winter months. So men would die from exposure, from frostbite, in addition to being served almost rancid or rotten rations, which contributed to the disease that men suffered with on board.
We're speaking with Katie Turner Getty about her interest in history. And there, one of the articles that you wrote, I read in the articles that have appeared in the Journal of the American Revolution, which is an online publication, as I understand it. And you tell the tale of a man named Thomas Painter. Now, was he on the Jersey? I think I seem to recall he was on a different ship.
He was. He was put on most likely the Good Hope prison ship, which was in the Hudson River, moored in between New York and New Jersey. And I thought Thomas Painter was extremely interesting because he actually escaped from the Good Hope. And in studying prisoners of war, you do come across a few handfuls of men on occasion that managed to enact these very daring escapes from the prison ships.
Did he keep a journal, or did he recollect this story after he had gotten back home or in later life?
He wrote a memoir a little bit later in life that kind of harkened back over his whole entire life, but a part of that story concerns his capture and his very short stay on the Good Hope, and then his subsequent escape as he tried to make his way back to West Haven, Connecticut, where he was from.
Why? How was he captured? Was he part of Washington's army in the New York City area?
He had been. He had enlisted in Washington's army, but his term of enlistment expired, and he became a privateersman. So he was serving on an armed whaleboat out of Connecticut in Long Island Sound. And as many of your listeners, I'm sure, know, a privateersman was on a ship serving on a privateer, and these were vessels that had special authorization from a state to interfere with and harass British shipping, and also to possibly capture British ships to take home as prizes to be sold, and the crew, the owners of the privateer, would make money.
So Painter serving on a privateer ship, that was a common source of the prisoners who went to prison ships. I mean, some of them were from Washington's army when Washington's army had to leave Brooklyn and get over to New Jersey. But quite a few of the ones who were imprisoned on the ships were seafaring people.
Absolutely, yes. And as the war progressed, my sense is it became very systematic. Men that were captured at sea, privateersmen, would be loaded onto some type of a transport ship and brought to a prison ship, and they would be processed and held on board the prison ships. So it was kind of, especially during later in the war, you see a lot of privateersmen, men captured at sea on the prison ships, and men that were captured on land, like during the battles of New York, were put into the jails of New York City on land. There are definitely exceptions. You see that a lot, but speaking generally, that's pretty much what it looked like.
Tell us what was life like for him, or as he described it, on the Good Hope.
He was put on the Good Hope when he was about 20 years old. And the first thing that he noticed, and you come across this in other accounts left by men who had been imprisoned on prison ships, was that a lot of the fellow prisoners were suffering from smallpox. And as we know, that was an absolutely dread disease. And if you hadn't had it already, you were vulnerable to it. So Thomas basically took one look around and saw so many men around him suffering with smallpox. And he decided that he needed to get off that ship. And as he describes it, that was one of the motivating factors, that he was in fear of his life due to the conditions on board the ship. And he decided to take his chances one day during a kind of chaotic experience that was going on board, on deck. He literally jumped off the prison ship and swam to the Manhattan shore.
Wow. And you write, I believe the story is that he had saved up his rum ration. Maybe the British didn't do much for them, but they gave them rum. And he used the rum to get the sentries drunk?
Yes. As he explains it in his memoir, he and a fellow crew member from the whaleboat that he'd been serving on saved up their rum rations in a bottle. And one night, they were allowed up on deck to get water. And this also seems to be a common thread. Men were allowed up on deck during daytime hours, but were typically locked in the hold of the ship overnight. But the custom seemed to be they could take water below deck with them. And so when Thomas was allowed on deck to get his water, he and his colleague offered the rum to the British guards on deck. And the British guards took the rum, proceeded to drink it, and then kind of neglected their duty. Other prisoners came out onto the decks. Chaos ensued, and that was Thomas's moment. That is when Thomas jumped off the ship and swam to shore. But as I discussed in that article, as bad as the conditions were on the prison ships, once a prisoner managed to escape, he was still in a little bit of a predicament. Thomas swam to Manhattan, which, as we know, had long been in the possession of the British since the battles of New York. So for an escaped American prisoner of war, he was in really hostile territory, and it was quite a challenge for him to manage to get off of Manhattan and find his way home.
Mm. Ultimately, he swam from Manhattan over to New Jersey, right?
He does, unbelievably. He found himself on Manhattan completely hemmed in. His thought was to walk home from from Manhattan to West Haven, Connecticut. And in other prisoner accounts, it's interesting, you see that same mentality. Once they escape, they want to walk home, and they try to. And they typically encounter a lot of challenges and obstacles along the way. And so as Thomas, he found himself on Manhattan trying to walk off the island, but he couldn't. Every which way he turned, he would be faced with British guards or encampments. And so he felt that he could not safely make his way past them. So he was stuck in this position for about 4 days. He began sitting and staring out at the Hudson River, realizing that his only chance to get off Manhattan might be to swim the Hudson. And that is exactly what he does. After even several days without having any substantial food, he swims the Hudson and miraculously makes it to New Jersey.
Well, he's got to get something to eat, and he doesn't know whether the people he meets are friend or foe, because there were both loyalists exactly. and patriots in New Jersey.
It is so fascinating for me to think on the experience of these men after they defied the odds and managed to escape from a ship. They were still kind of confronted with this territory where people's allegiances were unclear, and that you could not tell who would be friendly and who would be hostile. And yet these men were also destitute. They were traveling with no food, hardly any clothing in some instances, and they had no access to shelter. So in many cases, they would be forced by desperation to call at houses and ask for help. And that was tremendously dangerous, as if they ran into the wrong person, they could very easily be sent back to the prison ships, or who knows what could happen. So in many cases, they would have to call at these houses, and various things happened. As you go through different prisoner narratives, many of them have very different, very individualistic experiences, but that common thread is kind of approaching strangers, asking for help, almost throwing themselves on the mercy of people due to the exhaustion and the starvation that they were enduring while they were on the road.
Thomas Painter, as I recall, had a good encounter for his first meeting with people in New Jersey, although he thought the guy who was encountering was maybe going to get him, but he didn't. He helped him out.
Exactly, yes. He saw a farmer working in a field. Thomas was nearly collapsing at this point. He was sinking in the road in exhaustion. And he ended up approaching this farmer and asking for help. And the farmer did not react well at all. He reacted super threatening, approached Thomas while he was holding a scythe, by the way, since he had been working with grain in his field, and he kind of yelled at Thomas, demanding to know who Thomas was and where he came from. And Thomas ran because he was terrified. But as he did in that moment, the man kind of immediately changed his demeanor, his tone of voice, and he said something along the lines of, "Wait, it's okay, I'm a friend." And Thomas stopped, and the man said, "You know, this could be a trap. I thought you could have been sent here to trap me, that you were a spy. I can help you." And he does. And it's this really kind of stressful, scary episode where you don't know who this man is. You as you read the memoir, you think Thomas is in imminent danger, but the man does turn out to be friendly. So it's a really clear case of kind of these unknown political allegiances, and also the vulnerability of an escaped prisoner on the road in unfamiliar territory.
Eventually, Thomas Painter gets home.
He does. Thomas Painter gets home. And it's funny because very recently, I was just searching for a little bit more information on Thomas, and I found photos of his home in West Haven, Connecticut, that were taken in the 1930s. And it was just kind of, it kind of came full circle for me, because this was the home that he was born in and that he lived in for the rest of his adult life and until he died. And it was incredible to know that this home still exists, actually, although interestingly, it was moved from West Haven, Connecticut to Litchfield, Connecticut, where my understanding is that it actually stands today as a private residence. So Thomas Painter made it home.
Did he get back into the war, or was he done with war?
He was still serving as a privateer, and he did more. He did several more episodes of that. He became a sailor. After the war, he served on merchant vessels going to and from the Caribbean for years, and which it's almost miraculous that he lived to such an advanced age, because it was such dangerous work going to and from the Caribbean. But he did that for years. He later bought interests in other ships that paid off, and he actually became pretty financially comfortable later in life. He became a prominent citizen of his town. He ended up having a long, happy life, which is not bad for a boy who was orphaned by the age of 13 and kind of had to make his own way in the world.
Was this prison ship system, if we even want to call it a system, important to the British? Did they do it throughout the war, or did they eventually give it up?
They did it throughout the war. There were still prisoners on at least the Jersey as late as 1782. And that was about the time where it seems like the number of men on the prison ships is just totally thinning out. And so my understanding is that the Jersey prison ship itself was simply abandoned, probably about 1783 or so. And it was left to decompose and rot. But during the digging of the Brooklyn Navy Yard, which I think was about 1906, I've come across some newspaper articles where it seems kind of like the skeleton of a ship was found, all the heavy timbers, and it was thought to be the Jersey.
Now, I doubt that the Americans imprisoned the British on ships, because the British had a lot of ships. The Americans didn't have that many, or did they imprison them on ships?
I am not aware of any British prisoners of war being kept in or on American ships. It may have happened. I may just not be aware of it, because, again, if there was a case of exigency, you can see how a ship would make a good holding place. So to my knowledge, I don't know of any British prisoners that were held on ships. There may have been some, but probably not in such a systematic way as the British had devised.
Katie Turner Getty told this story about prison ships to the annual conference on the American Revolution, which is organized by the Fort Plain Museum and held at Fulton Montgomery Community College, and that's how we heard about Katie. Katie Turner Getty is a Boston lawyer, a writer, and independent researcher. Her articles appear frequently in the Journal of the American Revolution. Thanks for joining us, Katie.
Thank you so much, Bob.
Again, you're listening to the Historians Podcast. I'm Bob Cudmore.